Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, July 19, 2016. Red Cross workers go about collecting bodies of people killed during the fighting in Juba.
Bodies were scattered in different places, and that's the main issue. And we started first with residential area, pumping, and then we went to Gudele, and Gudele has, Gudele is too big also. And then we went to checkpoint, and then from checkpoint today, we ended with the western side of Jebel Kibir.
And the Committee to Protect Journalists is calling on the Kiir administration to release Alfred Taban.
The cornerstone of any functional democracy is a robust free press, and South Sudan has consistently demonstrated itself as sort of being both unwilling and unable to respect or protect that from the part of the political elite.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The South Sudan Red Cross has taken up the daunting task of collecting the dead bodies of soldiers and civilians from last week's fighting in Juba. After a full week of burying the dead, a Red Cross official in South Sudan says the agency relief workers hope they will finish the job very soon. Ayen Bio reports for VOA from Washington.
South Sudan Red Cross workers have collected hundreds of bodies over the last week from several areas around Juba. Mariel Mayom, a communications manager for the Red Cross in South Sudan, says the collection began at Juba Teaching Hospital on Tuesday, a day after the unilateral ceasefire was ordered. Mayom says their mission is to provide a safe and dignified burial for all those who lost their lives in the fighting. After the work at Juba Teaching Hospital was finished, he says they moved to other parts of the city,
including residential areas, and, bodies were scattered in different places, and that's the main issue. And we started first with residential area. We started in Pompeii, and then we went to Gudele, and Gudele has, Gudele is too big also. And then we went to checkpoint, and then from checkpoint today, we ended with the western side of Jebel Kujur.
Mayom says it took them 2 days to collect all of the bodies from the western side of Jebel Kujur. Mayom says he did not see any children among the dead, but some were civilians. It is unclear exactly how many people died in the fighting. Mayom says his organization is not in a position to disclose how many bodies they have collected because they do not have the capacity to determine whether or not the deceased died as a direct result of the fighting.
The South Sudan Red Cross is not in a position to give out the numbers of the dead bodies that we collected. But what I can tell you is we collected bodies from the SPLA and the SPLAIO and civilians. This is what we did, and we buried them according to these categories, actually.
Mayom says his team is doing its best to identify the dead and contact loved ones, but that task is becoming increasingly difficult as the days pass and the bodies decompose.
Now, like more than 7 days after the fighting, and most of the bodies are beyond the recognition. It's not easy actually to recognize. And what we did is just to differentiate between the civilian, and we took the record. There's a paper where we just write in the paper, and then we put this paper into the body bags, because in the future we just keep it as a reference, and we keep the record of the places where we pick all these bodies.
Mayom says the main role of the governmental authorities has been to provide the aid agency with burial grounds. He says the government eventually gave them land in Giada, where most of the soldiers have been buried. Later, they were given land in the southern part of Jebel Kujur, where they buried most of the civilians.
What we did in the last 7 days was not an easy job, and it was not easy. And my request is to all the parties to respect the international humanitarian law, and also for us not to get ourselves involved in the collection of dead bodies, because if there is peace in the future, we'll not be involved in what we were doing in the last 7 days.
In an email response, the International Committee for the Red Cross said the government of South Sudan was working on the operations of burying the dead. The Minister of Health could not be reached for comment, despite repeated attempts. For VOA News, I'm Ayen Bior in Washington.
Internally displaced persons sheltering at a UN camp in Juba since the fighting started in December 2013 say they don't have enough food to eat and their children are starving. Aid agencies say they don't have enough food in stock to feed the IDPs because soldiers looted WFP warehouse in the capital. Tito Justin has this report for VOA from Juba.
At least two IDPs at the UN camp in Juba say they are starving because they have not received their monthly food rations. Rebecca James, a widow and mother of two, fled to the camp in late 2013. She says she has been voluntarily teaching other IDPs how to feed malnutritioned children in the camp since arriving. She says most IDPs share their food rations with new arrivals who fled their homes when fighting once again erupted in Juba a little more than a week ago. The UN says 36,000 civilians are seeking shelter at its camp in Juba. Rebecca says no IDPs at the camp have received food since July 8th.
My house is empty. No milk for child, no food for adults, and no everything. And there is no shop even you have a small money, you could not even find anything in the shop. All the things are already finished.
Acting ANIMS spokesperson Santel Passad says food distribution was delayed this month because the WFP's warehouses in Juba have been looted.
Humanitarians are working with what they have to distribute the food to both at UN House and at Phnom Penh.
Last week, WFP reported 4,400 tons of food were looted from its main warehouse west of Juba by armed soldiers. Rebecca says women like her are too afraid to leave the camp and look for food because of gunmen outside the camp.
What I want to tell to anyone who just holding their gun, let them recognize the rights of the citizens. Because we are here in POC, we are citizens. We don't have part. We are not belong to IO, we are not belong to government. We are all citizens of South Sudan.
IDP Kobong Kobom says sheltering at the UN camp used to be tolerable because IDPs would receive their food between the 5th and 12th of every month, but now he finds it difficult to survive. For VOA News, I am Tiro Justin in Juba.
The spokesman for the UNHCR says nearly 5,000 South Sudanese have crossed the border to the neighboring Uganda since July 8, when fighting broke out in Juba. The UNHCR spokesperson in Uganda says South Sudanese security agents are not allowing male South Sudanese to leave the country. Mungoma Dev Surakarinj has more for VOA from Kigali.
Charles Yaxley says more than 1,500 South Sudanese crossed into Uganda on Sunday alone, which has compounded the number of South Sudanese seeking asylum in Uganda over the past few days.
This is attributable partly to the easing of roadblocks and checkpoints on the Juba to Nimule Road, the main road to Uganda. A number of vehicles arrived and accompanying the convoy of UPDF military trucks that are helping to evacuate Ugandan nationals.
The UNHCR spokesman says unidentified armed militias are still preventing young South Sudanese men from crossing the border.
More than 90% of the new arrivals are women and children. There are reports from the refugees that armed groups are preventing young men from crossing and that this is hindering them being able to seek refuge in Uganda.
Yaxley says most of the new arrivals are coming from Eastern Equatoria State, while a small number are coming from Juba, the epicenter of the recent clashes. According to UNHCR, South Sudan ranks among the countries with the highest levels of conflict-induced population displacements in the continent. Nearly one in four South Sudanese citizens is displaced within the country's borders or in neighboring countries. Yaxley says most of the refugees are tired and hungry after walking for many days carrying their belongings. He says others suffer from malnutrition after walking without food for days. Humanitarian agencies, UNHCR and the Ugandan government are providing food and shelter to the refugees. Godfrey Byaruhanga works with the office of Uganda's Prime Minister, which oversees refugee affairs.
Most of the rich here, when they are hungry, we have to give them more energy biscuits and water to drink. And then they are screened. After screening them, they are immunized against polio and measles. Polio for those who are 5 years and below, and then measles for those who are 15 years and below, and then they are taken to the settlement.
Yaxley confirms the UNHCR is running out of supplies and is particularly concerned about the children.
Almost two-thirds under the age of 18 present specific challenges in providing appropriate child protection, legal protection, as well as the education facilities. These are supposed to be the generation of tomorrow, the generation that will lead and rebuild South Sudan. But right now they're suffering enormously.
Anne Encontre, UNHCR's regional refugee coordinator for South Sudan, released a statement last week saying the number of South Sudanese refugees in the region could surpass the 1 million mark this year if cross-border displacement trends continue. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Ruakarinj in Kigali, Rwanda.
Vatican envoy is urging both President Salva Kiir and First Vice President Riek Machar to peacefully end the wave of violence that gripped the capital for 4 days, leaving hundreds of people dead and thousands of others displaced from their homes. As we hear from Tito Justin in Juba, Cardinal Turkson met with President Salva Kiir today and delivered a message from the Pope.
Cardinal Turkson says he discussed with President Kiir the need to peacefully end the recent conflict in South Sudan. The pontiff's envoy says President Kiir assured him that he remains committed to restoring peace in the country. The cardinal says he wanted to meet with the first Vice President Riek Machar, but Machar's whereabouts have not been disclosed after the fighting broke out in Juba last week. Cardinal Turkson says the president told him he is receptive to meeting Machar.
The president is again open to receive Riek Machar. His position is still there. I don't think, as the African Union was talking about, if a whole foreign contingent should come here for that to happen, I don't think they will be happy with that.
Cardinal Turkson says President Kiir has agreed to welcome an arrangement of a third-party security force to ensure Machar's safety, but is opposed to any foreign troops staying in South Sudan. The cardinal says he also asked President Kiir to share the content of Pope Francis' letter urging peace with officials in the transitional government of national unity. During his visit, Cardinal Turkson also met with hundreds of internal displaced people sheltering at a UN camp in Juba and witnessed firsthand how they were suffering from years of fighting.
How can we ensure safety and security for the people so they can live in their own houses and be able to provoke development in this area? To establish credibility with the international community, the AU, the European Union, and other people, so they can, you know, find their way, you know, helping South Sudan to develop and to grow.
The papal envoy says he also met the SPLA chief of staff Paul Malong, who briefed him on the latest casualty figures. Turkson called it unacceptable that such a huge number of civilians and soldiers were killed.
The chief of defense supports about 300 people plus, you know, who lost their life in the exchanges and everything that happened there. It's a very sad thing. When I told the Pope, he also expressed a desire someday to visit South Sudan. You know, you have to lose 300 people of your population, whether they are soldiers or not. It's not a comfortable thing.
Cardinal Turkson passed the condolence message to the families that lost loved ones and discussed with Malong the need to quickly resolve the conflict and restore peace in the country so that the suffering can end.
From the visits we made, the need for, you know, protection against mosquitoes, the need for malaria medication, the need for a certain amount of dysentery or diarrhea, cholera-related type of thing, and the most important, medical supplies and food.
The pontiff's diplomat urged the South Sudanese people not to lose hope, adding he believes that one day the country will overcome its hardships. For VOA News, I am Tiro Justin in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, the Committee to Protect Journalists is calling on the Kiir administration to release South Sudanese journalists still in detention. That story is coming up.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
What do you think? people speak out on important questions. The question today:
do you feel you have access to adequate health care? Why or why not?
No. I see most of how the government money is put into other facilities, other ministries, which would have been, first of all, education, then health. But most money is put into defense.
Yeah, because there are hospitals around, you know, private clinics and the government clinic here and there.
No, this is because the health centers are mostly far from where we are staying.
I'm not so certain. At the moment, there has been a shortage of money, and hospitals nowadays are kind of expensive to some people.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. It's time for our Tuesday health segment. Today we are talking about AIDS. Legal activists say they are concerned about the growing trend that effectively criminalizes people with HIV in many countries, including the United States. VOA's Anita Paul spoke to lawyers at the International AIDS Conference in Durban.
No known law makes it outright illegal to simply have HIV. But human rights lawyers say people with the virus are often treated as criminals. 72 nations have laws that specifically apply to people with HIV, most of them concerning disclosure. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention last year reported 24 U.S. states require people who know they are HIV positive to disclose their status to sexual partners, and that 25 states criminalize actions that have little chance of spreading the virus.
So all those laws are quite problematic in terms of the fact that they stigmatize people who are living with HIV. They put unnecessary burdens on people who are living with HIV.
That's Nairobi-based human rights lawyer Alan Maleche, who sat in a small private booth with other lawyers at the conference and dispensed free legal advice. Maleche says he is fighting a request from the president of Kenya for a public list of all children living with HIV, which lawyers argue is a gross privacy violation. He has also represented numerous tuberculosis patients jailed for not taking their medication.
And my worst horror story ever, an ongoing case before the High Court of Kenya, is doctors carrying out tubal ligation of women who are living with HIV without their consent because they believe that women living with HIV who are getting pregnant are putting their lives at a risk because their immune system will be suppressed. And so they then go ahead and carry out tubal ligation without their consent, a gross violation of human rights at the hands of healthcare workers who are supposed to safeguard the rights of women who are living with HIV.
In meetings before the main conference, advocacy group AIDS Free World championed the case of Ugandan nurse Rosemary Namubiru. Namubiru was sentenced to 3 years in prison after she was accidentally pricked by a needle, and the mother of the child she was treating accused her of reusing the needle on the patient. The young boy tested negative for HIV. Activist Paula Donovan of AIDS Free World says Namubiru is one of many HIV-positive people who have been unfairly prosecuted.
And this happens frequently with cases of criminalization of HIV, that with no transmission whatsoever, and even when there's no possibility of transmission, they are still being brought up in front of courts and charged with heinous crimes, even when there's no possibility that it could possibly cause the transmission of the disease.
Donovan says the law does not need to change, but everyone, regardless of their status, should be treated equally under the law. Anita Powell, VOA News, Durban, South Africa.
The Committee to Protect Journalists is adding its voice to the chorus of voices calling on the government of South Sudan to release veteran South Sudanese journalist Alfred Taban. CPJ's Africa Research Associate Kerry Patson says the Kiir administration is clamping down on the media. CPJ's Africa Program Coordinator is also urging authorities in Juba to allow Taban's newspaper, the Daily Juba Monitor, to publish freely. Kerry says freedom of speech is the benchmark of a democratic society.
South Sudan, which has been experiencing a high level of conflict, particularly of late, and sort of a closing space on media. So we've seen a lot of threats against journalists, editors, as well as sort of other civil society actors. And unfortunately, in Alfred's case, what happened was that he published a column that was seen as being sort of too critical of the current ruling party. It was calling for a greater UN presence. It was calling for the resignation of two top-tier politicians, and that wasn't so well received by those at the top.
A lot of government officials are saying South Sudan is a democratic society. Why is this happening in a society like that?
The cornerstone of any functional democracy is a robust free press, and South Sudan has consistently demonstrated itself as sort of being both unwilling and unable to respect or protect that from the part of the political elite. You know, we see a sort of consistent trend of journalists facing threats or harassment or intimidation on the parts of officials. And the reality is that, you know, yes, elections are a good step, but that's not enough to make you a democracy. And having such a blatant disregard for or hostility towards the press really hinders any sort of meaningful democratic process.
And apart from Alfred Taban, are there any other journalists who are in detention in South Sudan that you know of?
We have, you know, been closely monitoring and are aware of other cases of physical attacks or assault, threats or intimidation, or other sort of attacks on press freedom of various forms throughout the country.
Following this recent flare-up of fighting in Juba,
yeah,
a lot of journalists have expressed fear that they are not able to work inside South Sudan. Do you know of any cases of journalists who have fled the country because of the recent crisis?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I will not use anyone's names in particular so as to, you know, protect their anonymity and their safety. Certainly, we have seen cases of journalists who have been forced to flee as a result of, in some cases, threats of arrest or torture or physical assault. In other cases, for fear of their inability to continue working in the country. And what you see is sort of an exiling of some of the country's talent into other countries where they can hopefully continue working. But this circles back to your point about, you know, South Sudan being a democracy. The reality is that if the very people who are supposed to hold power to account are forced to flee in order to protect themselves, then what you have is a democracy that isn't working very well.
Journalists in South Sudan, some of them who are too afraid to do their work or who have escaped from the country outside South Sudan, is there any group, any organization that can help them to, you know, bring them back to business? I mean, for them to practice their work?
I mean, that's sort of a tricky question to answer. I mean, there are a number of press freedom organizations who help with different parts of it. I work for the Committee to Protect Journalists, and we do emergency support. So we are in the position of helping people actually flee or support them, you know, as they try to leave. In terms of supporting people as they set up and get back to work, there are other organizations that engage more on the development and training side. And what we have seen in other instances, for instance, if you look at the mass exodus of journalists from Burundi into Rwanda, is that you saw the Rwandan Journalists Union really pick up the slack and try to sort of create opportunities for or support the exiled journalists coming in. And so what we're hoping to see is more of that in countries where people leave, though ideally nobody is forced to flee in the first place.
That's CPJ's Africa Research Associate, Kerry Patson. She was speaking to me from New York earlier today. George Livio, a journalist with the UN's Miraya FM, was detained last year by South Sudan's National Security. Since then, he has been in detention. Several South Sudanese activists are calling on the government to release Taban and Livio. At the now-concluded African Union Summit in Kigali, participants launched the African e-passport for continent's leaders, agreed to help the African Union become more financially self-sufficient, and postponed the election of a new chairperson. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has highlights from the 27th African Union Summit.
Perhaps the most notable action, or inaction, to come from the summit was that delegates did not elect a new chairperson. None of the three candidates contesting the position received the necessary two-thirds majority vote, so the elections have been postponed until January and will likely include new candidates. Alyssa Jobson is the advisor on African Union relations for the International Crisis Group.
I think there's been general consensus, and even among some of the member states themselves, that the three candidates were
not the best that Africa had to offer. So, you know, we've got an opportunity now that gives the member states a chance to look and to find better candidates, someone who can guide the African Union at what is actually quite a crucial time for them in terms of peace and security.
In a step towards self-reliance, the AU agreed to levy taxes on certain imports in order to fund itself, since external donors supply much of its current annual budget of almost $500 million. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, through his spokesperson, noted what he called the innovative funding arrangements aimed at providing the AU, via the Peace Fund, with increased financial means to address the peace and security challenges facing the continent. J. Peter Pham, director of the Washington-based Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, says it's about time.
Whether this is actually achieved or not remains to be seen. Up to date, it's been rather embarrassing that for an emerging continent, Africa is extremely dependent upon outsiders to even fund its own governance mechanisms.
The African Union announced its support for a request made by IGAD Plus, the East African regional bloc that includes Rwanda, South Africa, Nigeria, and Algeria, for African troops to help UN peacekeepers in South Sudan. That country's peace is tenuously holding under a ceasefire announced last week after violence rocked the capital, Juba. That request, which now goes to the UN Security Council, includes a revised mandate asking for the deployment of a regional protection force. Jobson says this sends a strong message.
Which sends a sign to Juba that, you know, the continent is serious about this, and that, you know, that they do want to see the violence ended and a lasting resolution found.
South Sudan's president, Salva Kiir, has rejected the idea of additional foreign troops entering his country. Separately, the first African e-passports were issued to AU heads of state, permanent representatives of those states, and ministers of foreign affairs, aiming to ease restrictions on the movement of people, goods, and services across borders. And Morocco formally asked to rejoin the African Union. It left the Organization of African Unity, the AU's predecessor, in 1984 because the AU recognized the independence of Western Sahara. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
That's our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song Salam Ya Sudan by Victoria Ole. Been listening to Dedica Sang and Victoria Ole with the song Salam Ya Sudan. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.